crisis. Now, you can study education one bad idea at a time, or you can kind of stand back and then look at the whole century and say, look, this is what was happening in slow motion for the people going through it. But we can look back and say, now, here's where they went wrong, here's where they went wrong there. I call this the big picture or the overview approach. Both are helpful. You really need to go back and forth, because knowing the details about any one of these gimmicks won't get you but so far. And if you got too much distance from the thing, you don't have a sense of the fact that each of these unfolded in very complex ways. Okay, if you study American education during the last century, one feeling is going to stand out above all the others. I'm predicting this. And that feeling is bafflement. The people in charge call themselves professional educators. And I don't mean teachers, I mean the administrators and the superintendents and so on. They call themselves professional educators, but they continually work to diminish education. It's like meeting chefs who detest food and don't believe in nutrition. What's going on? Okay, here's the answer. Okay, around 1890, and we're talking 130 years ago, right? Education was a brand new field. Americans with a PhD in education hardly numbered 100 or 200 from my sense of the articles I've read. They had the fervor of new converts, in their case to psychology and sociology and then to socialism. And what they did across the board, they executed one of the biggest bait and switch operations in history. They eased education in the traditional sense of the knowledge business of information, facts, wisdom, really. And they took the schools out of the knowledge business and snuck them into the social engineering business. They weren't asked to do this. Nobody in society wanted this except the conspirators themselves. So there was an incredible in-your-face arrogance. We know the truth. We know where history is going. We studied Marx. We know everything. And this arrogance is half the answer to our question. Okay, another aspect is these ideological adventurers were, as determined as they might seem, they knew that America was not interested in the goods they had to sell. Now, this is very important. They knew. And so we come to the second half of the answer. Secrecy and deceit were going to be big players in this game. Our so-called educators embraced the endless lying that has deformed American education for 100 years. Now think of someone leading a double life. A con artist comes to steal your bank account or your house, or a pedophile befriends your family, but they, of course, a pedophile pretends to be a nice guy and he's just trying to be a nice guy. But you know you have to be careful. And the truth cannot be spoken in a lot of these cases. So what happened unfolded in kind of a secret, gosh, a strange way to think of it. It's like there could be ghosts on the street or in the building. You think maybe you see them, you're not sure. Well, the educators laid low, but they were busy, busy, busy. So what started happening around 1890, but gathering force in 1900 and 1910 and 1920, and really energized by the Great Depression in 1930, the fathers of education worked in stealth to transform the United States into a different country. Their brave new world would be populated by simpler, more pliable citizens. The elite educators set about creating tomorrow's dumbed-down citizens by altering today's children. They could do this by managing the public administrators. To do that, they needed to dominate the education schools, such as teachers' college. It was not a casual conspiracy. It was tirelessly pursued over many decades, almost entirely unseen, but behind the scenes, as they would say. Now, here's some of the things people were thinking in the 30s, because the fall of the crash of the stock market in 1929, for these people on the left, was a good omen. It was wonderful news because it said that Karl Marx got everything right instead of everything wrong, which I would say was more exact. So Harold Rugg, who was one of the big writers of textbooks intended for the schools, well, as you'll see in his quote, they were swooning. Now, you might think I'm exaggerating because there hadn't been anything like that since that time. But that was to go from the roaring 20s, where everybody's getting a new car, a new Ford, and everything seems to be going great. All of a sudden, the Marxists and the communists now knew that Moscow was going to win. America was now losing. It was all written right there in front of them. So Harold Rugg, in his 1934 book called The Great Technology, said this: "Through the schools of the world, we shall disseminate a new conception of government, one that will embrace all the activities of men, one that will postulate the need of scientific control in the interest of all people." Look at this guy. New conception of government. He's not talking about education. Scientific control. All people. He's talking socialism at the least, and communism probably. I believe that the most interesting history is intellectual history, and that's what we see here. In other words, these are the ideas that the average citizen doesn't know about or hear about. Maybe people who read obscure magazines. But it's all taking place right there. If you really can, what do you need, an infrared telescope or ultraviolet or whatever it is that lets you see in the dark, that's what you need to see the nonsense that's going on in American society by the time the 30s started. So most people assumed that the educator people, the education establishment, were interested in a certain set of things, but in fact they were against all of those things. And this war played out mainly on three fronts: academic content, the country itself, and children in general. So now let's look at these three fronts. I mean, if you had a map of a big war, like Germany invades Russia, you have three fronts: the left, the right, and the center, however you want to put it. Okay, against content. For all the centuries leading up to this strange war, through the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, our smartest people sang the advantages, the joys of learning, of knowledge, of understanding the world. But John Dewey and his colleagues said, nah, who cares about all that stuff? It's overrated. We're going to bring you ignorance. But ignorance, if just the thought is a simple person like you, it's all you need. And Orwell coined that phrase, ignorance is strength, because he's a very clever guy, and he saw the implications of this ignorance that was spreading. And here's John Dewey, our big number one guy, and he said things like, "I believe, therefore, that the true center of correlation," whatever that means, "on the school science, school subjects, is not science, not literature, not history, not geography, but the child's own social activities. I believe that this gives the standard for the place of cooking, sewing, manual training, etc. in the school." This is outrageous. I told you these people want social engineering, not academic content. You can just see it there. He's got rid of everything, and he's got them down to cooking, sewing, and manual training. I believe this was written around 1900. And there's a book called The Pedagogic Creed, which is quite shocking because the whole thing is one sentence after another. I believe, I believe, I believe. See, it's social engineering mixed in with religion, a new sort of religion. Now listen to this next one. This is G. Stanley Hall, and he's talking about reading. What is a foremost educator in the country at that time, early 1900s, have to say about reading, or in his case, not reading? Here's what he said. "The knowledge which illiterates acquire is probably a much larger percentage of it practical. Moreover, they escape much eye strain and mental excitement, and other things being equal, are probably more active and less sedentary. It is possible to cite the stigma our pedagogical age puts upon this disability for those who are under it, not only to lead a useful, happy, virtuous life, but to be really well educated in many other ways." So you see, we've got the whole top echelons of the education people lining up on the sides of illiteracy. They find nice things to say about it. Less eye strain, more strenuous. That's because you'll be digging ditches. This is really shocking stuff, but this is where they were. It's in that kind of pompous professor prose. Now, here's another quote which should stand right over the door, like it was at which prison place was it where it said "Mach"? Let's see, "Arbeit macht frei." The Germans said it says "Work will make you free." You know, one of those quotes that just sums up the whole nightmare. 1929, and this is probably, well, this is right there when the crash was. I assume the book was being worked on, but I don't know. This might have been written in response. I forget when, I thought that thing was in the fall, but never mind. Anyway, these Thorndike and Gates are two of the biggest people in education. There's only about 5 or 10 big names, and this is two of them. And they wrote in their book, which is not intended for the public, it's intended for professors in training. Okay, here it goes. Artificial exercises like drills on phonetics, multiplication tables, and formal writing movements are used to a wasteful degree. Subjects such as arithmetic, language, and history, those are the three big ones, include content that is intrinsically of little value, that the typical school overemphasizes instruction in these formal academic skills as a means of fostering intellectual resources is a justifiable criticism. I mean, really, the biggest educator in the country saying facts and learning are not something you need to bother with. Now let's move on to what these people thought about their country. Dewey spoke of a coming society where everybody would be more interdependent, code for socialistic. He also advised change must come gradually. To force it unduly would compromise its final success by favoring a violent reaction. Now, in general, the Depression made these people almost giddy and therefore more talkative. George Counts is another one of the big names, Counts with an S. In 1932, listen to this guy, he's swooning right here. Historic capitalism, with its deification of the principle of selfishness, its reliance upon the forces of competition, the place of property above human rights, and its exaltation of the profit motive, will either have to be displaced altogether, or so radically changed in form and spirit that its identity will be completely lost. Well, that's one in either or, where basically there goes America, as presently figured. So what these people wanted across everything was less religion, less family, less free enterprise, and less content of any kind, traditional content. They wanted more socialism, more secularism, and more world government. That's what's going to happen to the country. Now let's look at how they approach children. Now, education was a new field at that time, in the same test tube as another new field, psychology. All the other early people studied in both areas, circa 1890, 1900, around in there. Most of them studied in Germany and were influenced by a Germanic Hegelian sensibility, which exalts society and denies importance to the individual. To make things worse, all of the foregoing got mixed up with a love for psychoanalytic theory, conditioning techniques, and running rats through mazes. What the psychologists did with rats, our new educators wanted to do with children. Edward Thorndike summed up the mood in his 1906 book, The Principles of Teaching Based on Psychology. Quote, "The aim of the teacher is to produce desirable and prevent undesirable changes in human beings by producing and preventing certain responses." So you notice there's nothing to do with facts, knowledge, wisdom, or even competence. He's talking about how to move them this way or that way. Just what you'd want to do to a rat. You might have heard of the phrase cannon fodder. You know, that's when you send soldiers into the teeth of the machine guns and the cannons and so on. Well, in a way, the kids were ideology fodder. There were so many new theories in play, and everything ended up destroying the world that these kids thought they might be going toward. And all these early theories tended to view children as raw material that you could shape into anything you wanted. That's not the way to go at education. So the priority for the children was to get along well with the group. Knowledge could make a child independent and hard to manipulate. So ignorance became a plus. So the ed schools, the teachers, the educators, everybody was soon entangled in a conspiracy to make children dumb. That's why years later, Charlotte Iserby could write a book called The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. All right, now this crisis continues. That's the summary headline. Education can be used to liberate or to control. George Washington, Ben Franklin, and all the other founding fathers just assumed that education in America would be a tool for liberation. It should have been. It could have been. It still could be. Quite unexpectedly, our educators went the other way. Their bizarre zigzag is the cause of the continuing crisis in education. A group of these neo-educators selected and mentored the next generation of educators to be exactly like themselves, as did the next and the next. And so we move forward toward the present with our education establishments incestuous and inbred. A little bit of Faulkner here, I guess. Misshapen by inherited disorders like a sickly clan marooned in fog-shrouded mountains. Thus, in 1979, Gene Lyons, a famous, semi-famous writer, could write a bombshell article, Why Teachers Can't Teach, that teacher education was a mammoth and very expensive swindle of the public interest, a hoax and an intellectual disgrace. Now that's what it is. 40 years ago, already it was that far advanced. They're not teaching them anything. The whole thing is a swindle. Now, in 1983, a government panel issued the famous Nation at Risk report, which said that if foreign powers had attempted to do to our schools what we had already done, you would think that the people were run by enemy aliens. And we could view these changes as an act of war. And I believe this was a cute way, a very kind of subtle way of saying our educators are an unfriendly foreign power. And furthermore, how does this happen? In 1990, Rita Kramer visited some of the best ed schools and wrote a book titled Ed School Follies. Still an excellent book. I have a review on it. And the thing she noticed in going to all these schools was how little of the activities in these places had any connection to intellect or to what the children would learn. Everything had to do with, are you ready for this? Socialization. All activities and games and everything was really about a certain kind of kid they wanted to create. Now let me just sum all this grim stuff up in a very simple way. If you're a socialist, or for whatever reason you don't like our country and you want America to be weak, then you will have to feel deeply pleased and proud with the job done by our educators. On the other hand, you will not be pleased. Sadly, the crisis will probably continue until we systematically terminate each of the bad ideas put in place a century ago by a small gang of subversives and saboteurs. First step, let's face the truth. Education in America is a disaster deliberately designed and created and sponsored and promoted. And that's the way it is right now, just like it's been for 60 years. But now it's up near the surface, so nobody can say, oh, I didn't know what was going on. I'm telling you it's going on. And it's easy to track it and see it. And that's what some of these podcasts will be about individual things, reading, a complete fraud when it's not done with phonics, and Common Core, and many, many of the techniques, as they're called, theories and methods, techniques. And really, it's one little fraud after another. I wish I could tell you there was some good news, but actually there isn't. On that happy note, we will close until the next time. Overview. Let's Fix Education explores 7 of my favorite themes. First, this podcast is a meditation on what I call the K-12 crime scene. So many destructive ideas. Understanding them is the key to fixing them. 2, by doing that, we will have better schools at less cost. 3, nothing much changes decade to decade. The big questions of the 1930s were the big questions of the 1960s and the 1990s. Any subject we discuss can easily intersect with any other subject. Most people instinctively want traditional education, but the education establishment fills classrooms with progressive gimmicks. The result is that we have a standoff, and that's why you run into the same ideas over and over. 4. The big brains in education keep telling students, don't bother memorizing this or that. You can look it up later. B.B. King, the great guitarist, is much smarter. He said, The beautiful thing about learning is nobody can take it away from you. 5. Lenin's ghost wanders through our school system. The hard left thinks big. If they have to kill millions of people to build their perfect society, that's okay. Same goes for dumbing down millions of students. Totalitarians want power. They will do anything to get it. 6. If we are going to survive, we have to take each child to his or her limit. As it is, we are creating millions of sub-educated students, from K right through college. 7. Analyzing education, especially dysfunctional education, is a lot more intellectually interesting than most people suppose. You'll enjoy this. Finally, P.S. My book, Saving K-12, runs parallel to everything discussed on this podcast. I also have an education site, improve-education.org, with 70 articles that complement everything discussed here. And I have hundreds of articles on the internet. Enter a topic in Google with my full name, Bruce Dietrich Price, and let Google make suggestions. Thank you for visiting.